Welcome to Federal Insights, sponsored by Akamai. Here's today's moderator, Tom Temin.
Federal agencies continue to work at establishing the cybersecurity protection state known as Zero Trust. Although the administration established a Zero Trust policy a couple of years ago, knowledge and understanding of it continues to expand. For an update, I spoke with the senior cybersecurity researcher at the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory, Elena Peterson.
Our goal really is to help the government prepare for the needs in the future for cybersecurity and do some of the ground level research so that they can put into operation very good technologies for mitigating cyber risk. So that's what the national labs do in cybersecurity generally. We also help them in their operational spaces because we do have a lot of really great talent in that area.
And what areas of research do you focus on? Because cyber is such a wide topic.
It is a wide topic. At PNL, we focus on quite a bit of it. I personally work a lot in the malware space in both software and firmware. I also work in some of our supply chain areas. I dabble a little bit in the zero trust area. I manage a lot of cyber folks that do work in a variety of areas.
Well, let's talk about some of the trends you're seeing. Say, you mentioned in the malware area, and you know, the last I heard about malware, and I'm no expert on this, is that the big problem is very tiny programs that are hard to detect that sit around for a long time in your network and may activate. And even though they're small, they have the, you don't want them to execute. What's going on these days there?
There's a wide range of issues of malware that still exist. It seems that the smarter we get in trying to defend, the folks looking to attack are equally smart and get a bit of ahead of us at times. Tiny programs that sit and wait are something that we focus on a little bit of trying to find by looking at what they might do and looking for them before they execute. Another kind of upcoming trend is a little bit in the firmware space. So the code that's sort of embedded on hard devices that you might see in critical infrastructure or other things and that could have some bad effects. Detecting malware in those spaces is something that we're looking at. As well, the big one that I think a lot of people know about is ransomware. And that's still a decent sized problem for folks to deal with and trying to detect and prevent ransomware from executing and causing harm economically, especially.
And malware in firmware, that's a tricky topic because very often you can't really update the firmware because it's firmware and manufacturers set it and forget it and it's in maybe non-programmable chips. So is the issue there the ways into firmware that the user may not have, but that the nefarious hacker can have?
That is definitely possible. We're looking a little bit more at situations where firmware is going to naturally get updated. You have OT systems who want their firmware updated because they need the latest thing to work. And we are looking at ways to just confirm that those updates are valid updates. That process hasn't introduced bad code, malicious code, or even code that's going to cause other issues. Even if it wasn't maliciously done, we can still protect especially industrial control system kind of things from bad code in general. So that's kind of our focus. But yes, the area of firmware, it's hard to grab firmware and test it. It's not like a binary. We can just get it and look at it. Getting it off of the machines without hurting the machines sometimes is a hard process. So there's a lot of work in this space, but it is a sort of a new frontier for the bad guys to get in and for us to try to protect.
What are the physical techniques for that? Because if you have a piece of laboratory equipment or a piece of process industry equipment, it might be embedded in a big metal case or, you know, the metal case is welded to a pump or something. I'm just making this up, but
sure.
It's not something you can load and from the internet like the latest Microsoft patch.
Right. If your question is, how do you get the firmware off? That's a big research area that's being worked on in a variety of places. We're not focusing in that part so much is understanding if you have access to the firmware, how can we study it without having to execute it? Because we're not wanting to execute it on a big machine. So how can you statically analyze it to look for either changes in the firmware that shouldn't exist and or identify any malicious code that's in it?
And how do you deal with the different languages for all of these different applications, because one industry might be reliant on C#, another one might be something old, you know, some older language that goes back to the 80s, you know, for the manufacturing automation protocol or something.
Exactly, which is very true, especially in the OT world. We have a lot of legacy systems out there. Some of the research that we do is independent of the language. So we'll look at the actual the compiled part of the firmware, and we will disassemble it. We can detect what kind of language was used and then disassemble it and go at that level and take it down to a sort of a more common level without having to worry about the actual language itself that it was coded in.
And will manufacturers provide source code if you ask for it?
Sometimes they will. Yes, sometimes they don't. We are actually running into that issue in our supply chain research as well, because it's very nice to get source code if you're looking at supply chain versus trying to figure out what all's in a piece of code, right? Without the source code. So sometimes they can, sometimes they don't. Sometimes we just have to reverse engineer.
Yes. And does the research focus on specific systems or on strategies for classes of systems? Because when you think of the world that is controlled by software, it's the whole world. And if you just say electrical grid, well, there's tens of millions of nodes running software on the electrical grid. You can't look at them all. So is your research focus on strategies more than specifics?
Yes. Yeah, it's definitely focused on the general underlying understanding of something like software and firmware, and how we might analyze it, prove it in a couple of specific cases, depending on who's funding us to do work. Also, they may have some very specific cases that we can look at, and then working towards the translating that out to the broader community. But a lot of times it comes down to the very basics of the computing infrastructure, architecture, hardware, that you can get at least a large leg up on understanding how to find the malware or analyze it or even prevent it. And then you can take that into the very specific use cases.
And let's talk about that research agenda. You say there are people that come to the lab with specific tasks they want done. How does that happen? Mm-hmm. Who brings it in? And how does your agenda get set?
So we have relationships with most of the government agencies, especially in cybersecurity area. And we work with them to help them understand what we think the future issues are going to be and what the research needs to be to solve the problems, because we have those relationships. We're Department of Energy National Labs, but we work with all of the government agencies. And at times they will put out calls for proposals and they will have very specific research areas and we can apply for grant-like funding from the agencies. Other times they will come and visit us and see some of the work that we're doing and then say, hey, that looks very interesting. Does that work in my space or can we expand on that or can we put things together and solve some of their more specific problems? So it's sometimes it's organic. Sometimes it's having dinner with a particular sponsor and talking about the world's issues and coming up with a possible solution and then writing proposals to do the work or teaming up with other labs in academia to do work and even private industry for us. And other times it's a little more formalized with calls for proposals that might come out from the agency itself.
And is there a mechanism, you know, among the labs and maybe some of these other members of your greater community to make sure that people aren't duplicating effort? So that, you know, Los Alamos and PNNL aren't working, hey, I'm doing the same thing. That's redundancy.
Sure. I wish I could say yes, there was a really great system for that, but it is the government. The government can work a little bit in silos, I will be honest. The great thing about the National Labs is that we all do work for the various agencies. So we can at some times let one agency know that there is some good research being done in another agency. If we're talking about the open world, we publish as much as we can, and that gets people to understand who's doing work in what area. There's also conferences that you can present at. The national labs work very well together, so we're well aware of the kind of work that the labs are working on, and so we will often either pair up with them to get bigger, broader projects solved, or we could even point a sponsor to folks that are very, very in-depth in a particular area that maybe we're not so in-depth with. It's not a perfect system by any means, but it's hard to coordinate across the entire government space. Cybersecurity hits everyone in the government. They all have some sort of responsibility, but they also have their own mission spaces. And so their focuses will be different. So the idea of sort of coming up with one completely countrywide strategy in cybersecurity is probably not possible given the different missions that each of the agencies have. But we do try to coordinate when we can.
And now that we are in early 2024, what's on the agenda for you specifically this year?
For me specifically, I'm working very much towards the malware space, as I mentioned, really trying to develop our particular technologies and capabilities in supporting OT malware, the cross of operational technology and malware, which puts us in that firmware space. So we have some good technology that can detect malware in the software space, and we're researching how we would use it in the firmware space, and give folks in the OT communities a little bit of assurance there. That's a lot of my focus. I help with, like I said, the supply chain aspects, and we have some great capabilities in developing what are called SBOMs, software bill of materials, and even hardware bill of materials. The idea of making sure you know what's in a piece of software that you get, and you understand what vulnerabilities might come along with that. Then you can assess the risk of using that piece of software. That's easy enough for newish software, again, harder for legacy software where you may not have source code and now you have to interrogate the software and to try and understand what is inside of it, what it consists of. Most pieces of software that you get have other people's software in it, right? It's not all built from scratch. And so we're doing a lot of great work in that area. And then we do some work in zero trust and a few other things. We dabble in a lot of things.
Elena Peterson, Senior Cybersecurity Researcher at the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory. We'll have more of the interview after this short break. I'm Tom Temin.
Hi, I'm Mike Richmond of the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. Veterans, do you take medication? At VA, prescriptions have a range of copay levels, from free to $5, $8, or $11 for a 30-day prescription, depending on your eligibility. Sign up at va.gov, call 1-800-MY-VA-411, or visit your nearest VA medical center. I'm Mike Richmond.
Welcome back to my interview with Elena Peterson, Senior Cybersecurity Researcher at the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory. I'm Tom Temin. Our topic is zero trust and how it continues to evolve. Zero trust, we tend to think of the human user and their mobile device and making sure that the zero trust extends to them. But in many ways, would it be fair to say the zero trust architecture has to take all of these non-human entities that are accessing software, especially in the control space and the industrial controls that you mentioned that you're working on and these operational technology, zero trust is very real for that area too, correct?
It is. It is very real and it has a lot of the same issues, especially with legacy systems. Putting zero trust principles on legacy systems is a tough order and is an area that we're doing some research in. So yes, machine-to-machine communication is something that zero trust can really help with, which is the same kind of thing as, you know, something like a cell phone talking to a cell network. That's essentially machine-to-machine communication. And in fact, we do a lot of work in 5G and securing 5G, which is based on zero trust principles for its higher level security. So,
and maybe what's your working definition of zero trust? That might help people listening to know, because there's a reference, I imagine, definition of it, but everyone says it's
sure.
A little bit different.
I will phrase it as succinctly as possible of never trust, always verify. So people may have heard the phrase, trust but verify, we say no. Never trust, always verify. So that the idea is that there's always continuous verification, there's always strict access controls, those kinds of aspects of protection. So it used to be that you authenticated in, say you set a password and you authenticated into a network. And once you were in the network, you're kind of in a safe space. You're in a secure zone and you could do anything you wanted practically. I'm being a little bit broad here. And now with zero trust principles, You can get into the network and do some things, but if you're going to do the next thing, you have to re-authenticate. Well, oftentimes that authentication is done on your behalf behind the scenes. You're not constantly adding your password. But if you don't have the right credentials and your level of credentials can't get you into that next phase of something, you won't be able to get there. That's one version of it. The data that's getting passed around from these machine-to-machine communications is encrypted at sometimes, you know, the highest level, but at least at some level. There's the idea of network segmentation, which is this once it's instead of one all-encompassing network, there's actually a bunch of smaller networks that then talk to each other. And that way you get the authentication between those networks. And if you're in one, even if you've breached it, that doesn't mean you can go breach the others because of the zero trust architecture.
And I had a question in the operational technology or the functional infrastructure technology area, and that has to do with the idea of real time. People misuse the word real time, meaning really fast. And you want your human users to have a really fast response, but they rarely need a real-time response in which a kernel process of the processor is interrupted by a particular call so that there is instantaneous occurrence. That's real time. And so I'm wondering in, say, an aviation system or a transportation system where you have to have real-time response for certain phenomena to make sure that planes go where they should, et cetera, does the zero trust and the verification spoil that idea of real time, or can it coexist with real time?
Yes and no, and it all comes down to design. So if we look at what's happening in 5G, zero trust is the design principle for 5G. So if it's designed in, then you can work in as near real time as physically, and I mean physics, possible. Like you said, real time is somewhat of a relative term. But real time in the requirement of what you need that real time to be. So in new designs, secure by design, you can get there. If you're going to bolt security on top of a system, then you're probably not going to get as close to real time as you might need to. In legacy systems, we're going to have to deal with security versus performance. We are doing some research in exactly that. There are OT systems that need to happen in a matter of cycles. Right? Not minutes or seconds. And we are working on some first order principles that we can put in place that can happen at that speed. It might not be a full zero trust architecture, but certainly certain some things. Encryption can happen very fast, especially as we get better and better and fancier encryption techniques, et cetera. So we're looking at what parts of zero trust can we do in real-ish, real enough time to be effective and not have the kind of negative impact that you implied on our OT systems. But again, new networks being designed with zero trust principles really does help.
What is the essential challenge mechanism in a non-human intervention? I mean, you need authentication and identification. All these things have to happen. And you can visualize how that happens with a person. How does it happen with a bot or a command or an automated call from, you know, the bullet train sees a bunch of buffalo on the track up ahead?
If I understand your question correctly, there are a set of zero trust principles that are generally designed in or on top of something that expect some level of authentication. And or encryption of the data. There's got to be some sort of understanding in that design of those interactions. So you're not going to just walk up with two systems that don't know anything about each other or don't work in that same space and have them work together securely. We're not at that level yet. It's not standardized to the point where everything sort of operates in that one same space. It's being designed into the variety of domains as it can be and where it needs to be. I think that answered your question.
I think so, yes. Thank you.
Okay, and good.
On the topic of network segmentation, which commonly gets called micro segmentation, whatever that means, any link from point A to point B, I guess, is a micro segment. This is not something that a human can actually execute because there's millions of micro segments in a given system. How do people get there? This is a software-derived thing. I guess maybe the question is not so much how you do it, because there's tools that give you that, but how do you have visibility into what's going on once you have that?
The tools are called software-defined networking. And so now the networks are defined in software. And so being software, then you can You can get into the software space, design those networks as needed. That's how 5G is run, as well as by software-defined networking. And so you have, you know, the software engineers who can put all of that together. And again, depending on the space and the kind of network you're building, there are standards for how that's done.
Do you feel that there is a new kind of human capital requirement as we move into a world of zero trust, micro-segmentation, encryption, all of these things are still pretty new? Very often the operators may not be totally up to date. Is that part of the equation?
Yeah, if you're talking about the human operators and what zero trust architectures might do for them, definitely. I think you have to be careful if you put security in that is not efficient for the user and the operator, or causes them to not be able to do the kinds of things they really want to do. They'll often try and figure out a way to get around it. That's not good. And so you have to have the user in mind when you're designing these things. And you have to make sure that their usability is still where it needs to be. Now, they may need some training as well. I think we've all realized that we're putting passwords in a whole lot more. Passwords are getting a lot more complicated than they used to be. And it's that same kind of thing. You have to build up to understanding that that is going to be the world so that it can be secure, not just throw it at them all at once, but certainly make sure that your design doesn't interrupt their ability to do the work that they need to do.
And a final question on software bills of material.
Uh-huh.
Great sounding concept, but the reality is these are really large digital documents, and there's a couple of different standards by which SBOMs are to be published. But is it your sense that people know how to actually use them, even if they are published in I forget what they're called, but there are standards for SBOMs. And if you get a standard SBOM format, does the average functionary in a network operations center or a SOC know what to do with the SBOM?
So that's a great question. Probably yes in some cases, and definitely no in other cases. You're right. There are a couple of different formats for SBOMs. There's not really any hardcore standards yet. It's a very new technology. But there are becoming some regulations for creating SBOMs and from the government. And so there are starting to be, you will have SBOMs in if you're going to use software. So those places, the DoD, for example, have the understanding of looking for SBOMs. There's tools out there. The private industry has gotten in this space as well. So there's tools out there that can read your SBOM. But it is also a learning curve now. So now you have your sort of cyber expert saying, okay, this piece of software has these vulnerabilities. Now you have to understand what is the risk of using that software. And you may choose to use the software with those vulnerabilities in it because you need your need outweighs the risk of that vulnerability. And you may choose to go in a different direction because that vulnerability provides you too much risk, really depending on mission. So yes, there's going to be a new set of experts in that area. Risk management's always been something in cybersecurity. It's going to come much more to the forefront and we'll have the tool of SBOMs to help them assess the risk before they use a tool, as opposed to being hit with it after they've used the tool.
Sounds like you won't run out of work.
No, in cybersecurity, we will not run out of work in general, for sure. As computers get better and faster, networks get better and faster, the need to secure them will always be there and will always be sort of new territory. So no, I don't think I will run out of work.
Elena Peterson, Senior Cybersecurity Researcher at the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory. To hear this interview again or share it with colleagues, please visit federalnewsnetwork.com and search Insights. I'm Tom Temin.
Thank you for listening to Federal Insights, sponsored by Akamai on Federal News Network.